Good evening and welcome to Bingham Presents 2011 Enforcement After Dodd-Frank. We're broadcasting live from Bingham McCutcheon LLP in New York and online at www.sechistorical.org, the virtual museum and archive on the history of financial regulation. My name is Jeffrey Manns. I'm an associate professor of law at George Washington University, and I'm the moderator for today's program. The program is part of the Bingham Presents series, which is made possible through a partnership between Bingham McCutcheon and the SEC Historical Society. Bingham McCutcheon offers market-leading practices focused on the financial services industry, encompassing bank, securities, and investment law and regulation, financing, structured transactions, and restructuring. Its 1,100 lawyers serve in 14 locations around the globe, including such financial and regulatory centers as New York, Washington, Tokyo, and London. The SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times and currently welcomes more than 300,000 visitors a year. The Bingham Presents series debuted in 2009 to provide insight into current issues in financial regulation of interest to the legal profession. The previous programs in the series include Looking at the New World of Financial Regulation in 2009 and Harmonization of the Regulation of Investment Advisors and Broker-Dealers last year. All may be found online at the Bingham Presents section on the SEC Historical website. The SEC Historical Society is grateful for the continuing generous sponsorship of Bingham McCutcheon LLP for the series. That brings us to today's program, where we'll be looking at enforcement issues after the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act. Joining with me today to discuss the Dodd-Frank's impact on the enforcement of financial regulation are an all-star panel. We have Eric Grossman, the global head of legal operations of Morgan Stanley on my far left. We have Susan Merrill, partner with Bingham McCutcheon, LLP, and former head of enforcement for FINRA. David Meister, director of enforcement at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. And Robert Kutsami, director of enforcement at the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Our discussion this afternoon will focus on the big picture of enforcement after the Dodd-Frank. The big questions are, how does the SEC and the CFTC deal with expanded responsibilities and the greater challenges that a larger mandate brings? We will look at enforcement funding, derivatives reform, whistleblowers, and the broader role of private gatekeepers. Before we begin, I have to give the necessary caveat that comes with all presentations, which is all views are the views of the individuals. They do not reflect Bingham McCutcheon, the SEC Historical Society, the SEC, the CFTC, or anyone else's employers. The SEC Historical Society selected me to be the moderator. Bingham and the Society worked together to bring together this distinguished panel of presenters. So I've said enough, and now is the time to pass the baton on to the folks you came to listen to. So the first question we'll focus on today will be directed towards David and Rob. So then the question is, the Dodd-Frank Act has given the SEC-CFTC expanded responsibilities, but has the Act also given these agencies sufficient enforcement tools to take on these greater challenges? And David, if you would do the pleasure of starting us off, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much, Jeff, and thanks for inviting me. The question is whether or not the Dodd-Frank Act gives the CFTC, for my purposes, the sufficient tools to enforce the Dodd-Frank Act and our new authority. And I think the answer to that question is a solid yes. The CFTC has been provided with a new section of the Commodity Exchange Act, Section 6C1, which gives the CFTC new anti-manipulation and anti-fraud authority. It's broader authority than we had in the past. For example, with respect to manipulation cases, we can now go after reckless conduct, whereas before we were limited to going after intentional conduct. Our new authority also covers the swaps markets, which was previously beyond our jurisdiction. We also have broader fraud authority under our new statute. We have a Section 61 is modeled after Section 10B, which is obviously a broad catch-all fraud provision. It allows us to, I would say, be creative in our use of anti-fraud authority. We can cover fraud in the futures markets, the swaps markets, and also in the cash commodity market. We've already promulgated a rule pursuant to this Section 6C1. We modeled our rule off of Rule 10b-5 in the securities world, which again is a very broad section. Let me just wrap this up. In addition to the new anti-fraud and anti-manipulation authority, we also have a new disruptive trading authority under the Dodd-Frank Act. We have a provision that makes it a violation of the Commodity Exchange Act to provide the commission with materially false information. We will have new swaps dealer and major swap participant business conduct rules, which include anti-fraud authority. So we have a number of new tools, and we're pleased with that, and I think that we'll be able to use these tools in the most efficient way possible to enforce the Dodd-Frank Act.
Great. Rob, do you have any thoughts to add?
Sure. From our perspective, it's Dodd-Frank, I guess, it's kind of more like the 25,000-mile, you know, service of your car rather than the engine overhaul. I mean, there's a lot of provisions of Dodd-Frank that are really unrelated to enforcement. You know, systemic risk issues and the Consumer Financial Protection Board and the Volcker Rule and payment and clearing and settlement issues. A lot of it doesn't deal with enforcement. There are a series of amendments that provide us, and I'll leave whistleblower aside because that is significant, but that expanded aiding and abetting authority and penalties in administrative proceedings and nationwide service of process collateral bars, so we can bar registered persons not just from one regulated industry but from all. And those are all helpful, and they're ones that we've pursued for a number of years, and we're thankful to have them. The big impact for enforcement is going to be on the great expansion of the number of registrants, hedge funds, private advisors, municipal advisors, statistical rating organizations, and others who are now going to be registered, who are now going to be subject to inspection. And that's going to translate, I suspect, into greater number of referrals to enforcement and greater number of enforcement actions as a result. And that brings really to the issue more, I think, of funding, which is a continued issue for the commission. Greater funding was authorized under Dodd-Frank for the commission up to, I think, $2.5 billion in 2015. From the current roughly $1.1 billion, but that's authorization, that's not appropriation. And as I quickly learned in Washington, authorization without appropriation doesn't do much for you. And we didn't obtain independent funding, which was one of the issues that we had pursued as well. So I think it's going to put a challenge from a resource point of view to be able to handle this workload, and as well puts a premium on expertise, which we've done a lot to do. We've brought in a great number of private sector and other persons with expertise in many of these new areas. Enforcement now has bond traders and risk managers and former Wall Street structurers and muni bond traders and forensic accountants and a whole slew of persons who are actually part of our specialized units and will go into testimony and will advise and counsel the enforcement staff in investigations. Very helpful, but all this new authority is going to put a premium on that kind of expertise as well.
Rob, one of the things that you mentioned as one of your new tools is getting the administrative proceedings where you can bring civil penalties against anyone, not just registrants. But I've noticed that you didn't even use it against registrants, against broker-dealers in settled cases where you could have done it, and instead brought federal injunctive actions, even in the settled context. And those, I'm sure you know, have enormous collateral consequences for the defendants there, the respondents. And even though waivers are routinely granted, the process can be quite burdensome. And I was wondering why you don't use it more for registrants and whether you will use it more now for non-registrants as Dodd-Frank lets you do.
Well, I'm not sure about particular matters you're talking about, but look, it gives us, we are now able to make a decision as to which form we'll proceed in without having to have a thumb on the scale that we have cannot get complete relief in either form. So that is sort of now off the table. We're not forced into district court in order to be able to obtain a penalty against a non-registered person. We can now make the decision based on what we think is the best, and that's based on a variety of considerations. Some relief is available in district court. It's not available in administrative proceedings. There are different rules with respect to discovery and deadlines and other issues. So I can't give you a kind of a hard and fast checklist of when we go one form versus another. I can tell you now that at least we're better able to make that decision without having to take into account the disparity in relief that's available.
Great. Thank you, Rob. So let's move on to kind of the next question and trying to look at the issue of benchmarks for success. So assuming that the SEC and CFTC do have the enforcement tools they need, what are going to be the benchmarks for successful enforcement in the wake of the Dodd-Frank Act? And so, and ultimately, how will the SEC and CFTC themselves be able to assure the public that they indeed are living up to their mandates? And David, would you help start us off with that?
Sure. Our mission, the way I answer that is I look at what's our purpose. And our mission is to protect our market participants and investors and to rid the markets of fraud and manipulation and other abuses. And we have about 175 people in the entire division of enforcement. So we are fairly small. We cover the entire country. So with that number of people and that mission, the way I measure success is, what is the impact of the cases that we bring? Are we bringing cases that have, national impact that will protect, the most market participants in, say, in a particular case or the most investors in a particular case? And also, are we bringing cases that deliver a message broadly to influence market behavior? I don't think that you measure our success by the number of cases that we bring, for example, in any particular year, although this year we are setting a record in that regard. I think it's broader than that. I think you have to look at how well are we using the 175 people that we have. How strong is the message? How loud is the message?
Great. Rob, do you have any thoughts on this?
In some sense, benchmarks don't change because of Dodd-Frank. I mean, there's a host of new rules, and whether or not the rules achieve their purpose will depend on whether or not you see reduced occurrences of misconduct or manipulation or fraud, whether or not the costs of the rules, are not out of line with respect to the benefits, competitive issues, all those things, doesn't create regulatory arbitrage between the U.S. markets and overseas markets. There's lots of ways you can look at that. But from our perspective, from enforcement, I think the benchmarks are, is there a reduced incidence of fraud and wrongdoing? Is investor confidence in the markets returning? Do we see fewer complaints? And from our own internal workings, we've adopted in the last couple of years lots of metrics to measure our performance by way of both quantitative and qualitative metrics. How quickly we move our cases. We've created specialized units and other pockets of expertise in order to target the priority areas, sort of to get ahead of the curve. And so we're bringing cases earlier and sooner than before they're in the headlines and all the investor money is lost. So, a lot of these are admittedly soft metrics and may not be directly tied to Dodd-Frank and can be influenced by a number of factors. But we keep a close eye on what the division is doing, and hopefully we're getting it kind of right.
Great. Thanks, Rob.
Rob, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
My sense has been that over the years, securities and commodities misconduct has been sort of cyclical, right? So you have a flurry of bad conduct, take early 2000s, and then things seem to slow down, and then obviously you have another flurry. We're now 2 years out from the credit crisis. And I know you're bringing lots of cases related to conduct prior to the crisis. What are you seeing now post, really not post Dodd-Frank, but it just sort of post credit crisis and then overlapping with post Dodd-Frank in terms of new misconduct, for lack of a better term?
Look, there's still, as you say, a number of credit crisis-related areas that we're focused on. Financial statement and accounting misconduct is also, frankly, at least as measured by the number of restatements, has tended to be down in the last few years. Fewer companies restating their financials. People speculate as to the causes of that and wonder whether or not, as enforcement types are inclined to do, whether or not it just means that people are concealing things better, or whether or not the economic shakeout has resulted in people being more candid, or maybe everybody's communal efforts from socks on down and more conscientiousness and more attention in boardrooms and amongst auditors has resulted in fewer restatements. We're focused on investment advisors and third-party managers. Cycles come and go, crises come and go, but third-party managers are sort of here to stay, and in all likelihood will continue to manage greater and greater amounts of investor funds. So we're looking at a number of areas across there. Market-based, not just insider trading, but obviously some of the new market structure issues, high-frequency trading, algo trading, and direct access arrangements, a number of exchange-related activities. FCPA, we continue to get a large number of those, and they make up a pretty healthy percentage of the whistleblower complaints that we get. Municipal securities is an area that's caused us some concern because it's not regulated in the same manner as the U.S. public company issuer market, and lots of people are invested in it. And with the strain on state and municipal resources and valuation issues and infrastructure needs, it's an area that's concerned to us. So all those areas, I think, would areas that are priorities for us, in part because we're seeing some more evidence of misconduct there.
So I have a question now for Eric and Susan. You've had a chance to query the CFTC and SEC representatives, and I'd be curious, what's the industry perspective in terms of benchmarking successful enforcement? Hopefully it's not a paradoxical question, but if either you'll volunteer, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I think that the numbers are don't tell the whole story, but they're irresistible. And the press picks up on them, Congress picks up on them, and they don't tell the story. I think what regulators need to do a better job of is setting out their expectations and sharing with the firms what they're learning from all, not just from the enforcement perspective, but from the exam perspective, so that firms can internalize those lessons. And hopefully it will result in fewer and fewer enforcement cases. Certainly no one wants to have a giant enforcement case with their name in the headline. But sometimes those message cases that David was talking about are the ones that really do change the game. They change the way things have worked in financial institutions for years and years. And it's unfortunate that sometimes it takes an enforcement investigation to make those changes. But if the SEC and the CFTC could share more of what it's finding along the way with a broader group, I think that might help in making those changes without having to have the giant enforcement case.
And I'd say in terms of effectiveness, I think you won't really know until you know, right? So if you the judgment with respect to how the SEC Enforcement Division did prior to the credit crisis is informed by what we learned subsequently, Madoff or, some of the other cases that have been brought in the wake of it, which fairly or unfairly at least are viewed as a report card for how Rob's predecessors did. So that's what I'd say on effectiveness. I think that the challenge from our perspective is going to be, we're in a different. Most financial services firms now, at least those that were not regulated by the Fed before, operate completely differently. So they're just in terms of the internal transparency with respect to our regulators. In the old world, the Goldman Sachs, the Morgan Stanleys, the Lehman's are obviously not around. Barclays, Bear Stearns, for the most part, the relationship was principally with the SEC in terms of regulators. Now we have the Fed. with us every single day. And so I think what you're going to see I hope you'll see a significant decline in the number of cases brought against financial services firms, because they're likely not to be as many gotcha moments, because we're living with the regulators every day. That'll be a good thing, I think, in terms of a view as to what Dodd-Frank and ultimately the credit crisis led, and hopefully these guys will get some credit for that as well, because I think the cases that they do bring, therefore, will be more important.
Well, thank you, Susan and Eric, for comments about that. But let me build on one of Eric's points, which is under enforcement in the run-up to the financial crisis. Is there an issue of chronic under enforcement for the SEC and CFTC more generally? In other words, would marginally higher investments in enforcement allow both agencies to pluck the low-lying fruit? And either David or Rob, if you'd like to field that.
Would additional investments in enforcement result in more cases?
So the analogy would be with the IRS, where many critics have said if the IRS simply had more funding, had more manpower, they'd be easily able to go and uncover large-scale tax fraud. Is your perspective that there are similar issues of under-enforcement where there is fraud lurking on the financial sector, and if you had the additional manpower and the additional time and resources, you could be able to uncover that?
Yeah, look, I think that's pretty clear, although I think more importantly, not only would you find more fraud, but you'd find it sooner. And I think as a consequence of that, you'd be able to stop more of it from taking hold in the first place. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you look at the SEC Enforcement Division, which is, 1,300 people, there are, 30,000 broker-dealers, investment advisors, U.S. issuers, transfer agents that were responsible for regulating, and that's even before you get to the, thousands of hedge funds that are now come under SEC jurisdiction, and thousands of municipal advisors, and our ability to effectively investigate that activity obviously is significantly challenged. I think I've seen some common ratios of, 10 regulated entities for every one SEC employee, and that's the SEC overall, that's not the Enforcement Division, whereas the banking regulators operate kind of much more on sort of a one-to-one ratio. And so just the pure numbers suggest that there's much more that can be done. But, at the same time, that's not an excuse for not being smart and informed about how you deploy those resources. It's not simply a question of I want more, but you really need to be figuring out how you want to employ those resources, more expertise, more earlier intervention, more focused on priority areas, frankly a better investment in the SEC's own infrastructure and operations, so that enforcement personnel are spending much less time on administrative duties and other burdens, and better IT, and spending more of their time on investigation. So, I guess the answer is yes, but the obligation is for us to use those resources in a smart way.
So, just on that point, Rob, with all of that to do, why the heavy focus on the FCPA for the SEC? I mean, you've got this jurisdiction in the United States, right? All this potential crime that could impact U.S. investors, trading activity in the United States. I don't forget how many bureaus, but one of them is the FCPA. It's right up there with, everything that's more domestic. I'm just curious if you're allocating resources, why? And obviously the Department of Justice has concurrent jurisdiction in the FCPA space. Why the heavy focus?
Fundamentally, because corruption is a significant problem. For many, many years, the U.S. was a bit of a lone voice in this area, and we weren't seeing the kind of focus on corruption by regulators outside the United States. And, these are U.S. issuers, whose securities are registered in the U.S., and the activities in some or even many cases, you know, are known to or involved by the U.S. parent. So I'm happy to say that we're seeing greater cooperation across the globe in this area, a lot more activity by foreign regulators in working to stop corruption. But it is a significant evil that has a very significant impact on goods and services. It harms legitimate companies who are playing by the rules but who are losing business and losing competitive edges to those that break the rules. And Congress saw fit to give the SEC jurisdiction in this area for those reasons, and that's the reason why it's a focus of ours.
Let me just sure. We're obviously not in the FCPA space, but I think that Rob's last point is the right point, and it applies to us as well. I mean, Congress gives the agency certain authority, expects the agency to enforce that authority, and it's our obligation to do it, you know, the right way. It's a very leveraged game, this enforcement world. And I do think that small additional investments in the Division of Enforcement and in the CFTC at large can go a very long way, which I think is your point, Jeff, and I agree with it. In large part, it's also about prioritizing your resources. I mean, you know, I agree with Rob. You know, we can always make the next case, but the idea, and we can always ask for more money, but the idea is to use the funds and the resources in the most intelligent way possible, and to make, you know, to set your priorities and to follow through with them.
Well, thank you very much for your comments, David. I was hoping you'd announce a massive job program for law school graduates, but alas, we'll have to wait on that. But prioritizing certainly makes sense. So let's shift gears a little bit, and I'll ask a question for Eric and Susan, which is this. Did the financial crisis expose the limits of traditional transparency and disclosure tools in regulating financial markets? Or is the problem really we have too little disclosure of the type of information that market participants and regulators need?
I'll kick it off. I think some of the financial disclosure cases certainly dealt with the traditional failures to disclose, the types of information that prior cases have always dealt with. For example, the size of the losses due to subprime exposures and that sort of thing. On the other hand, some part of the problem was just simply that senior management and boards of directors were not understanding the types of risks that the companies were taking, and there was nothing in the disclosure rules that would require the kind of detailed analysis that would get that information out to the public. Still to this day, I think there are issues underlying investor confidence in large financial institutions because people are not sure exactly what's being disclosed and what's still lurking out there. On the other hand, I think some of the financial institution crisis cases have really stretched the traditional disclosure rules to get money back into the hands of some very sophisticated institutional investors who were absolutely playing the subprime market for yield. And in those cases, I think it's a little less of a good use of resources. Certainly disclosure cases where thousands of shareholders in public companies have been harmed from the traditional types of disclosure issues, I think those are fair game. But using those disclosure tools and stretching them to protect the big boys in the Rule 144A kind of instance, I don't think is the best use of those resources. And in terms of, you know, whether it's the right type of disclosure, I mean, I think even some of the Supreme Court cases going back to BASIC talk about the fact that there is something of an overload of information to people, and that's not good either. The trick, I think, is to take the types of risks that investors need to know about and to try to get those out into the financial statements in a way that analysts can write about them, even if the traditional mom-and-pop investors don't understand them.
I guess the only thing I'd say is, of course, the danger now in responding to the reality or the perception of poor disclosure before is over disclosure. So if you look at the size of our Morgan Stanley's public filings, they've grown exponentially in size and complexity, and I don't think anybody has the capacity, frankly, to really read it and understand them completely. And that's true, I think, of our peer firm. And I think that'll be true in the context of traded securities going forward as well. So you'll to the point where it becomes just noise. That is the risk to get to really what's important on the back of this. And I think the enforcement cases and frankly the day-to-day regulation and scrutiny that at least we and other issuers get from the SEC right now. I mean, we and every other financial institution get a comment letter every quarter on our public securities filings, which it used to be a rotation. Now the financial services industry is sort of in the hot seat, which is fine. They probably deserve to be. But the result of that is, you know, someone poring over our financial statements and all of our peers, and then we add 10 more pages to our Q and 30 more to our K to respond to, you know, well-intended comments, but that don't really get to what might be important from an investor. And if that then translates across the rest of the issuer community, and I think we've created a new problem that might, in some respects, be more troubling than the one that we're trying to solve for.
Great. Well, thank you, Eric and Susan, for your comments. So the next question would be focusing on the potential tension between the Dodd-Frank Act's focus on heightening individual and corporate accountability. And so the issue is the greater emphasis on individual accountability going to reduce settlement incentives for companies and, as a result, consume increasing amounts of agency resources? David, would you like to take that?
Sure. I guess I don't see a tension as between any focus on corporate liability and on individual liability. We, in our enforcement division, we focus on both. We are very focused on bringing cases against individuals when we think the facts and circumstances warrant it. I think it's important to hold individuals personally responsible for conduct, sometimes in and of themselves, or sometimes in addition to bringing a case against the company. You had asked this question before, and I guess I don't see the tension that perhaps that you're talking about. As far as, you know, let's think about a situation. Perhaps what you're suggesting is that, well, when we have an investigation against both a company and an individual, and we're coming down to settlement discussions, we would never trade individual liability for corporate liability. I mean, I consider those decisions to be separate decisions. If we think that if we want to bring an action against a company and the company wants to settle and we think that their settlement offer is sufficient, then fine, we'll do that. Whether or not the individual wants to also settle the case.
Well, and I suppose that I may redirect the question to our industry representatives, Eric and Susan. Does it change the calculus on your end in terms of looking at the dual responsibility of looking at for individuals and for the corporation?
Absolutely. I even if a law firm is not representing the individuals, certainly the fact that the regulators have what I think is very clear, a clear new focus on getting ahead, getting a scalp in a case, has complicated the whole equation. So, for example, if the company knows that it's going to have to settle this case, but it has a couple of individuals hanging out there, if it's a current employee, it's a nightmare. Even if it's a former employee, all the good work that you've done to negotiate the language that's going to be in the public document settling the case goes out the window if the individual is sued on the same day in a complaint that lists in very graphic language all of the things that you've spent months trying to negotiate out. So it does complicate things. I also think it complicates things for the regulators, because there are certain cases, certainly, where individuals are culpable and they have to bring those cases. But in cases that are really more of an institutional problem, bringing a case against an individual complicates it for the regulators, because individuals are nowhere near as ready to settle those cases as corporations are. And then resources that they thought they were going to be able to redeploy onto new cases continue to get spent on that same case. I'm not sure how much more deterrence or message they're getting out of that, except for in the cases where it's truly an individual who has done the conduct that's at issue and not an institutional problem.
Yeah, I guess I just it often comes down to a difference of opinion, right? So, you know, if the SEC or the CFTC takes a position that an individual has truly engaged in misconduct and the company has a different view of that, that's when it really becomes complicated, right? Because for the most part, most regulated entities, even if they believe they're right, will settle with their principal regulator to get it behind them, right? And everybody knows that. That's not a secret. And there are a lot of motivations to do that. And one of them, though, often is so that the press, the impact, the franchise impact of that will be not as significant for the firm if they litigate with their principal regulator, as well as all the relationship issues. If you throw an individual in there and there's a difference of opinion and it's a current employee, it makes it very difficult. So now my hope is that there's few of those, so few cases where we have a difference of opinion, and that there's a healthy recognition at the SEC and the CFTC that there are cases. Not every case against a company has to have a head associated with it. That sometimes there are collective, and I think I'm not saying that they don't recognize this, because I think they do in many cases, that there is a collective wrong, and therefore let's settle the case and get it behind them. I think what we're seeing now is more disagreements about whether or not an individual was sort of, you know, truly culpable, or whether they were just part of a group engaged in a practice condoned and recognized with the business that the regulators now think was problematic in some way. And that's where we're going to have, I think, and that's where it gets in the way and makes life more complicated for everybody.
Great. Well, thank you, Eric and Susan, for your comments. So,
well, let me just...
Oh, Robbie. Well, in that case, go ahead. Look,
as a general matter, individuals commit wrongdoing, corporations don't. And so, as David said, first and foremost, that's where we start. There are circumstances where... the corporate form, provides, a good faith basis for the conclusion that the individual didn't engage in wrongdoing, or a strong litigation defense that you would take that into account. And certainly we've done that, and, of course, you know, get heavily criticized every time we have only a corporate disposition, don't charge any individuals, but such is the... this is the life we've chosen, I guess, to quote Michael Corleone.
There's no winning, Rob.
But we're not out to get a scalp, to quote Susan. We're out to try and figure out whether or not the individual is engaged in wrongful behavior. And I understand the corporate desire to settle the case and the discomfort that